Blog Talk Radio.
Morning time here in Southern Ontario, and welcome to Masonic Home Companion. It's an absolute pleasure to have you back, and helping us in Canada celebrate what's known as a Father's Day. For those that are so inclined, it's interesting that we have holidays that are widely celebrated, civic and otherwise, and yet it should also remind us that these events, like anything else, don't define an entire population. So it's curious, as my daughter says, that type of thinking just sucks the fun out of everything. Ignorance is bliss, where wisdom is folly. I think something like that. I have to admit, life's a lot easier if you can just turn, close your eyes, turn away from the reality. But I think it's more accurate to say it's far more curious when we start to look at reality and there's no end of amazing, curious things going on in the real world. I'm sure that you're all doing well. This is the 16th of June, the 167th day of the year. Kind of interesting dates Masonically on this date. And this is the, let me just share a few of those things with you. We're going to get into some of the articles, try and wrap up the articles from the International Conference in History of Freemasonry. I'll try and share just some snippets with you in case you weren't able to to be in the crowd. The thought-provoking topics. So we're already down to the 16th of June, so woo-woo, we're heading in on to the summer solstice, longest day, shortest night. And it was about this date, let's see what's going on in this date, the 16th of June, 1821, the Grand Lodge of Alabama was formed. And then on the 20th of June, just coming up, during this next week, in 1812, the Grand Lodge of Louisiana was formed. And of course, in 1881, Albert Mackey, the Masonic author and Secretary General of the Supreme Council of the Scottish Rite, passed away. And on the 23rd, we won't be meeting until then, will we? Maybe the 26th. Wolfgang Goethe was initiated in Amelia Lodge in Weimar. That was in 1780, the philosopher. And of course, on that date, we've come up to one of the more central dates in Masonic history. June 24th, 1717, is referred to as the Premier Grand Lodge being formed in London at the Goose and Gridiron Ale House. there's another little topic you can work into your conversation with the boys. June 24th is coming up. And on exactly the same date, but in 1731, of a lodge meeting in the colonies that became the United States, there's an account book of St. John's Lodge in Philadelphia. I'm reminded that, this fascination with provenance. My lodge is older than your lodge. I'm trying very hard to understand what that means in the course of Freemasonry, except I think it goes back to everybody wanting to, you want to reject these notions of the death of ego and the death of, in order to emerge in a sense of pure enlightenment. Much, much easier to dismiss all of that lumpy part of our principles, the spiritual, metaphysical, occult nature of our order. Much, much easier to dismiss all that, except for this crowd that keeps tuning into Masonic Home Companion with an appetite. It was on the June 24th in 1791, the African Grand Lodge of North America was organized in Boston. Now, this is significant for those of you who are historians looking at antiquarians, looking into how things have developed and when, because that charter is still very important to Prince Hall, and it later became the Prince Hall Grand Lodge of Massachusetts. But it legitimized black culture, the existence, the equality of man at a time when we think historically the mankind was in the shadows. Racism and slavery were still part of their history, but I can't claim any moral high ground on that today. We have the marketing of children and women going on even to this day in some states that are being identified. It's hard for me to, perhaps some others, to reconcile any kind of trade agreement with the nations where we know people are doing it. But just like there's illegal activities going on here in this country or in your country, that does not define the nationhood. It doesn't define the Constitution and the greatness of the people. And certainly, like everything else, these are a small handful of malcontents and people that are exploitive. That doesn't speak to the common man, the average person. If we embrace the ideas of commonness, we embrace the similarities of human beings. And we are not born to exploit our brethren, but perhaps it is something genetic, some predisposition, but that doesn't correlate with the amount of stupidity and criminal activity that's going on and people trying to find a gap. It's all in the eye of the beholder. We now see the major countries of the world. We've got G8 going on, and the countries of the world are sitting up saying, hey, what about these corporations, these major international corporations not paying a nickel of tax because they're able to hire sufficient staff to exploit loopholes. And then take the, have the temerity to turn around and say, it wasn't against the law. it was. It was immoral. A lot of us think it's important to make that contribution to our country because it's necessary. For anybody to declare, dig their heels in and say, I'm bigger than my country. All right. I don't think much. Your country really hasn't had much of a, made much of an inroad into, you have to wonder about the growth of culture, don't you? Sometimes. Anyway, all of that aside, we're living in interesting times, brethren. And I want to talk to you a bit more. We'll get back into the international conference. If you still have our lovely friend and who passed on some work to us many, many years ago in the meaning of Freemasonry, that's William Leslie Wilmshurst, of course. I parked this because, I thought the shows were getting a little bit dry. it was probably because I was loading this up, slathering Wilmshurst with work by Albert Pike. Better and more interesting to talk about Pike it just creates such a dilemma for me. Because he's, there's no question he had an intellect. But he's also, I have to separate out the performer from the performance from the personality. Was there any greatness coming out of a despot? And can I embrace the benefits or the contributions objectively without also embracing the despot or the nitwit or the knucklehead or the cruelty of the person behind, if that was the case? So I have to separate out the man from the work. And for me, that's hard. It's not a simple game. I'm trying to be ethical about this, and I don't have a simple rule. I see so many folks that are able to just sort of cast aside any sense of the complexity of ethics and they see the world in black and white terms. Well, I truly think we're a little bit beyond that. We're Freemasons. The purity has been, the notion of purity and beauty has been pronounced to us in the works and represented in the workings of Pythagoras. Mathematics and geometry being beautiful, being consistent, there's honesty in that. It's the harmony, it's the music. So, if we're given to the sense of some of consistency and beauty of thought, maybe we need to look at things mathematically to help sort out this ethical consideration. All of that gone sideways talking about Albert Pike, but study Albert, take a look at his body of work, and you'll see for yourself that, it's hard to, if you're inclined to say people that live differently than I do have nothing to contribute, I'm not so sure. It's like I have to do a moral assessment of everybody out there. I'm not going to do that. That's not practical. And that's certainly not the way I want to live. But on the other hand, moral high ground is there to be taken. So we have some Masonic dates going on. Did you know that William, here, I'm going to just take us back a little bit. And relax. I hope you're in a comfortable spot. I keep forgetting to remind myself that some of you sit down with a nice glass of Dunwinning become pensive, or a nice glass of wine or a bit of espresso or a chilled glass of water. I hope that you are able to listen to Masonic Home Companion in a way that draws on or perhaps feeds your appetite for contemplation. I make no apologies that this type of work is not a soundbite. I can't come to any understanding with my brethren. Passing off in a couple of seconds or a couple of minutes a conversation in lodge. I need to sit down and think, have a moment without the distractions of strong character and personality and alliances, to think about the merit of what's being said. So if I'm successful, you're able to look at, please look at this work, listen to this work objectively and to the content also of what I'm sharing with you. I'm trying to be as authentic and keep the information as candid as I possibly can and as accurate as I possibly can. But if I bring to the surface a sense of, I don't think I can bring to the surface the need for critical thought and objectivity. Remember, there's a difference, there's a difference between critical thought and criticism. Critical thought is parsing things out, increasing the magnification, especially when we're looking at complex processes and complex ideas. Complicated, perhaps, is a matter of the way we look at things. It often seems to be. Along comes a greater mind, a keener mind that shows us, that makes these ideas accessible. It's not that you or anyone else is less able. I think the task for any level of intelligence is to make ideas accessible. That's not to say that all ideas are able to be reduced. I think that's work in progress. Another little fun fact here for you. When you're sitting back with the boys, you want to work into the conversation. William Scott became a master of the works in Scotland in 1584. So much for the notions of the 18th century start. Promulgated two sets of rules. And the first he did in 1598, regulating the masons of Scotland. That's the Scotland. Go take a look. That's a manuscript. And the second in 1599, a year later, giving the Lodge of Kilwinning number zero in the Grand Lodge of Scotland supervisory powers over the lodges of West Scotland. And it also uses the Fellow of the Craft term. So that's 1598. Huge. Interesting, huh? And the first record is made of the admission of a non-operative mason to a lodge in Scotland. His name was John Boswell. He's the laird of Auchinlech. And he became a member of the lodge in Edinburgh. And in that same period, 1680, the York manuscript number one, it's usually called the York Rolls, it is in the possession of York Lodge 236. It contains the word Freemason. Remember that when you climb into the Buick and close the door behind you, the idea of a car when it was originally built was not what you were parking your keister in these days. Same thing when we park ourselves into masonry. People seem to be wide-eyed when we start to talk about prominence. Well, we started without the 3 degrees. We started without these terms, the idea. It depends how far you want to go. It's Freemasonry organization or idea. Is it philosophy or is it membership? A bit of both, probably. The records of the Worshipful Company of Freemasonry, Masons of London, 1621, indicate that there were accepted and operative members. So it's not to say that was the first, but that was when, thank goodness, a secretary or scribe took a moment and wrote down a reference that is actually useful to us to this very day. So the first recorded initiation was in 1641. It was a fellow by the name of Sir Robert Moray, and he was initiated by a group of Masons into a Scottish regiment at Newcastle-on-Tyne. And we even have the date, of course, the 20th of May. And, you know, I think it's okay for us not to be all born on the same day. I think that's okay. If I walked around the lodge asking everybody the date and year they were born just so that I could sort out credibility, you would look at me as a bit of an oddity, perhaps more of an oddity than you already do. But when I look at, I think about lodges and I think about grand lodges, I think of us as a community related and linked through a standard approach to the craft masonry. So I don't, and so I, of course, like anyone else, I enjoy things old sometimes, and sometimes I enjoy things new. But the date of something doesn't necessarily define or give me much information about the current status of organizations. Long time ago, I realized, you know, when people are picking schools to go to, they will often look at the reputation of the school. But as I've heard different grandmasters explain to me, reputation is about yesterday, not about what's current. What if the talent that built the reputation are no longer there? What if? And in many cases, this happens with businesses and colleges and universities and galleries. People begin projects and then move on. So good business people, strategic thinkers, will exploit the sense of reputation that's been developed and try and project that as far as they can into the future. But that does not define what's going on day by day. So currently, so take the past with a grain of salt. Take it with a grain of salt. Think about, if you want to know what's practical, I think we all need the tools that are used today. We need to know, really, what have you done for me lately? What is there any vitality left? I would think it would be disappointing for all if greatness were left in just a brand or a title or a plaque on a wall. This was the Great Lodge of 200 years ago, and that's it. I'm not saying that necessarily is the case with all things old, but we have to keep in mind that life goes on and things change, and you change and I change and our organizations continue to change. And we call this evolution. So I'll just, you've heard me talk about John de Saulnier. He was born in Rochelle, France. He was born in 1683. So he's just a little younger than James Anderson, who was born in Aberdeen in 1680. And you know the two of those two were collaborators in the first constitution. Follow up with all of that right at this point. But it is, I want to talk about the passage of time again and the effect on Freemasonry. But here we're celebrating Father's Day, and it was created to complement Mother's Day, apparently, according to Wikipedia. And it's, you know, just it's a list of a lot of countries around the world, Venezuela, Thailand, Singapore, Russia, Romania, Poland, Netherlands, Norway, Pakistan, Macau, Korea, Iran, Italy, Japan, you know, the usual suspects, and then Aruba, Ireland, Mexico, Seychelles, Nepal. There's a lot of countries celebrating this. It was inaugurated, apparently. Now, I always take this, everything good was invented in one particular country that exists to the south of us, and I've discovered time and time again that ain't, nobody discovered apple pie. Father's Day was inaugurated in the 20th century to complement Mother's Day. Yeah, okay. And of course now it's, seems that it's become shrouded in a bit of lets us express a bit of sentimentalism and a connection of relationships. And I don't think that's at all bad ever, ever, ever. So let's wish fatherhood all the best on this special day. And remember that without motherhood, none of this would exist. Ah, we're going to talk about existence. Here, I need to talk to you a little bit about some things that make us sit up and realize just how great we have it, just how absolutely astoundingly fortunate we are for our very existence. I think this puts a lot of things in context philosophically, because in the 21st century, you know, we're still knocking away at replacing superstition with fact and reality to help our understanding. For a lot of us, we like to include both. We like to have an understanding or an ability to accept a bit of mythology and superstition, and it's important for us to know the facts. For others, it becomes almost embarrassing when we hear people talking about our ancients walking around with a dinosaur on a leash. Anyway, we seem to make mistakes when we rely on superstition. And I want to talk to you about some things. I hope you've had a chance to tune in the CBC's blog, webcast of 2 weeks ago by Bob McDonald on the Canada 2050. Because I want to bring to mind revealing context that I tend to think will help us help all of us to understand the beauty of the Masonic order. It's not to say that it's that this is the only way of thinking about Masonry. It certainly isn't. There's many, many different aspects of the order, but this is one that I think deserves a bit of our attention. And I want to bring up a little bit of this. Context of that I'm trying to get at here, dig down. I'm screwing around with the screens and stuff here. I've got trying to get to the paper that I want to talk to you about. Is about the history of the world, and we've had in the past periods of extinction that science is able to identify. I think it's very interesting to find out how we've identified these transitions or extinctions. But I want to share a little bit with you because there's from the look of this, if we look over the period of our history, our earliest history, it would seem that we would be coming into a sixth, that there's no reason that the periods of extinction will stop, because we have consciousness. You know, there's a creature on the face of the earth that is conscious of these events. Doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to impact on all of the processes that bring extinction about, predictable and unpredictable. The first was around the Cretaceous Paleogene extinction event, and this is when the majority of non-avian dinosaurs became extinct. There were five major extinction events. The first was the third largest, and this was during the Ordovician Cerulean mass extinction. It had most of these events, the species in the face of the earth disappeared. The Ordovician Silurian brought about a death rate of about 85% of all marine species, but it happened over a period of 10 million years. Keep things in context before we go shrieking, the sky is not falling. It began, but it ended over a period of 10 million years. And it was created, caused, we realized, by a lack of oxygen. The first one was created by a very, very long ice age. And so then after that period, that 10 million year period, we moved into the second extinction, or late Devonian. And this one was caused by a lack of environmental oxygen. More than 75% of all marine and terrestrial species disappeared. Now remember, the first one, the die-off was 85% of all marine species, and it was very gradual, 10 million years. The second, 75% of marine and terrestrial species disappeared, but this period lasted 25 million years. That was followed by a third extinction, Permian, Triassic. And it eliminated 95% of species. This one was a combination of the lack of oxygen, volcanic activity, right, and a couple of asteroid impacts. Now that one, that one's often referred to as the Great Dying. Okay, 95% of all species. But it lasted, remember, the first one was 10 million year window, the second 25 million, this third one was 100,000 years. Now, during the fourth extinction, Triassic-Jurassic period, 90% of all species died. That window was just 10,000 years. And it was caused, again, it was similar to the third, it was caused by massive volcanic activity, asteroid impacts, and very severe climate change. Now, we know this. You know, there's evidence. There's artifacts. We don't have to know it. Maybe I should say this is a science alert. Turn off this program now if you don't wish to go on and learn more about the planet that we're on. So that was the fourth extinction. The fifth, and this is the one we know a lot about, or most popular, was the Cretaceous-Tertiary, and it ended the age of the dinosaurs. And it caused the death of 85% of all species. Now, this last one was 65 million years ago. Okay? 65 million years. And this was generally, we're still rooting around. The general idea is that this was caused by major asteroid impacts. You know, it throws hundreds of millions of square kilometers of material into the atmosphere. It affects the ozone layers, affects the sun's impact on the ability to reach the earth, affects photosynthesis, affects plants, affects the animals that live off those plants, you know, food chain type of thing. So you can see the sort of is there a predictability to these events? Well, we know that five of them have occurred, and we're sort of wondering, you know, the present day, what's the interval for the next one? Will it be 25 million years or will it be 10,000 years? You know, those are the sort of the range that the best information we have is what's already happened. When there has been a die-off, new forms of life, animal and plant, have occurred. So, you know, there is opportunity. and but filling that, you know, when there's not enough, there's a big die-off and then there's not enough. So, you know, that it keeps species low. It to fill that in, sort of bring it back, seems to take about 10 million years. So the fifth extinction, which ended the dinosaurs, opened up niches, you know, ways for mammals to develop. And that period we know as the Pleistocene era. But the animals at the start, it took about, you know, many millions of years before they began to really thrive after the dinosaurs disappeared. So we have, you know, five extinctions. It's like from any calamity or crisis, there are opportunities for those who have the ability to think that way and see them for what they are. But this idea that any great idea, this notion that great ideas can die out, philosophies such as the foundation of free and accepted fraternity, is a little bit odd, isn't it? If these ideas are great, do we embrace them? And if they are, then there's some permanence to them. And if they're not, they're going to vanish. Not because I have dig my heels in and consider myself, you know, my ego is felt insulted by such a claim, but because the ideas have application for mankind, generation and culture aside. So the idea that I'd like you to think about and ask you about is to think about the Masonic order as expanding, just like the universe is expanding, and we know that it's accelerating. We're not always sure why. But Freemasonry is expanding. And the properties don't necessarily change just because, you know. But as we expand, do we get further and further? Is time passing us by? It's curious enough that I would ask you that question seriously. Do we, by studying, being very diligent, maintain the essence of our Masonic order so that the passage of time is necessarily irrelevant to Freemasonry? That, in fact, let's say, are there areas in the face of the earth where the purity, the purest, let's say the purest form of Freemasonry, I don't buy this necessarily, but let's say the form of Freemasonry that existed in the first day, that first moment, is still with us somewhere on the face of the earth. Well, back in the day, we now know, science teaches us that it wasn't the same shape as it was today. Expectations were very, very much different. So I'm going to let me try and tuck away, leave that with you. If we're expanding, you know, that it's not a combat. No, that's a bit thick, but it's not a battle. But is that how we have remained pure to our principles, by our ability to take the instruction to advance our study daily seriously, incorporating that into our lifestyle? And is that not the best way for us to stay stay linked to our you know, is it the respect for our past that connects us to our heritage? So, you know, when somebody talks to me about Freemasonry being fun, I guess if you say so, but if I can have fun with the idea. I can have pleasure and enjoyment, but fun seems to trivialize something very, very sacred. Again, it's, I guess, easier just to pretend, and those are all aspects of the order. We can take a very classic car. We can take a Duesenberg worth millions of dollars, so incredibly engineered, almost ahead of its time. And we can drive it around with a gentle touch. Or we can just pound the pedal to the metal and drive the doors off the old girl. I suppose we could stick an eight-track. We could stick some sound in there and have tunes cranked up. But, man, it just seems out of context. And that's the way I think not all ceremony is solemn and grave, and I would agree with that. But I seem always to be wondering where, I don't mind having that giggle and fun, but where is the sense of a little nod, the respect to our roots? In every meeting, I've thought that would have been foremost. Instead of the sort of, we sit through so many meetings where time is wasted. Most of them, I think, somewhere between 30 and 45 minutes is wasted just screwing around, as if it doesn't matter. Well, ask yourself, do you have a good turnout? Does your turnout match your membership? So, no good whining, is it? Think about it. 30, 45 minutes, I would say, on an average meeting. There are a few lodges that, if you want to see how things are run with a sense of awareness, there are a lot of lodges that out there that do it. But you can measure that. Not just an idea, an impression. You can measure it. Look at your watch. Does it start up? Does it start on time? Do you sit around? Is the attention drawn during ritual from the candidate to officers prancing around, walking back and forth to their chairs? It's like, why? Why? Why do we want to change the focus? Why do I wait 15, 20, 30 seconds until somebody sits down and another 15, 20, 30 seconds for somebody to then stand up? No anticipation. Is this like my time to prance around so you can all look at me? Don't I look fine in my tuxedo? Really? That's it? That's all you got? Sorry, but it has to be said, and it is being said, and I'm not saying anything that tails out of school, and I'm not saying it to be mean or heavy-handed. Certainly, those who know me better than that, but think about it. Is it necessary? I'm thinking if I start to join up the dots, like you, I try to understand. It's not that what's wrong. It gets tedious. What's wrong with the order? What's wrong with the meeting? It's about what's going on. Do we even, sit down and take a look? We're not speaking in tongues here. We just watch. All this is around us. Here, a little bit about some of the sessions that you're going to hear when you attend the International Conference on the History of Freemasonry. I hope have whetted your appetite. And of course, I had a nice little, had this all beautifully organized, and that went to crap when I knocked a pile of papers onto the floor here. So I'm going to talk to you about the observation on Freemasonry in the 18th century, Abigail Lyon's contrary vision of women in Freemasonry. I think I did that. So Walter Scott, I did that. Here we are. This is a paper by the Celebrity and Fraternal Alliance, Allegiance of Masons and the Klan. This is a session by called Fraternalism and the Ku Klux Klan. And this was chaired by Jeffrey Tysons. The first paper was by Miguel Hernandez, and it was called Friend or Foe, Grandmaster's Responses to the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. For this reference, says Hernandez, proposed to give a paper on the way grandmasters across North America reacted to the intrusion into their lodges of a rival fraternity, the Ku Klux Klan, in the 1920s. The presence of the Klan in American lodges was disruptive, you can imagine. Now, nobody comes up to you and says, you're a member of this lodge, you must not, you cannot. We're saying that there is an inclination. If there is an inclination, then it could possibly show up in our lodges. And they're saying that back in the 20s it did. The grandmasters disagreed entirely on how to approach the invisible empire, as it was called. Some were rabidly anti-Klan and forced the others, however, advised caution. Others advised caution and non-interference, or preferred to ignore the subject altogether. Far from being merely a paper on Masonic jurisprudence, Hernandez outlined the various underlying factors that forced or prevented a particular declaration. So again, remember that whole idea of standardization, where there was an effort to standardize globally, so every single lodge, every single bit of work would be the same. Well, we saw that was an interesting idea, but far more complicated than the capabilities that have been able to overcome. So this was, we're thinking, is there possible just to have a blanket approach, a blanket statement? Well, far more complicated. Hindsight, we look at it and it would seem very smugly. We can say, well, the answer is simple. Well, the answer is not simple when you're in the time and you're facing the various pressures and counterpoints, although the goal may be right in front of you. So just lop off their heads, and like the Queen of Spades would say in the fairy tale. So why did Indiana's 1924 Grandmaster Charles A. Lippincourt not openly declare himself against the Klan when he was a well-known opponent of the Invisible Empire? Hidden beneath the formal declarations of silence of a particular grandmaster is an account of turmoil and duty within America's lodges. So you put men with duty and commitment to their lodge. These are men of principle, wrestling with ethics. Good men, honorable people, our brethren. By studying Grand Lodge proceedings, Masonic and Klan newspapers, Hernandez brought to the fore an understanding of the awkward position that many grandmasters were put in. Building on previous work by Adam Kendall and Christopher Allerfeld, Hernandez showed the audience the true meaning of the formal and obscure declarations of America's grandmasters on the issue. Brilliant. So this second paper was Celebrity and Fraternal Allegiance in the Klan, in the Masons and the Klan, was delivered by Christopher Allerfeld, a Brit. Both these people are from the United Kingdom. It was Emerson who claimed that all history is biography. Perhaps he was right. Even if he wasn't, the study of the individual certainly makes a good historical tool, since the history of any society must ultimately be the history of the actions and interactions of its individual members with others, both within and outside that body. Got that? Really? That seems to fit. Let me play that one back here. All history is biography, so that's the quote. The study of the individual certainly makes a good historical tool, since the history of any society must ultimately be the history of actions and interactions of its individual members with others, both within and outside that body. So the whole is bigger than the parts. Hmm? But in order to understand the whole, you have to understand the parts. In the case of the clan and the Masons, that this is especially pertinent since in many cases the history, if not the members of the two, have considerable overlap, a fact which is made all the more apparent or contested at an individual level. What is more, the study of the individual clearly illustrates the impact of the ideologies of the two organizations and the behavior of certain celebrity figures. Given that in his paper, Allerfeld examined the implications of a selection of well-known Masons' careers and beliefs for the Klan and vice versa. Not sure what the point of that was. Using a wide variety of material and encompassing a time span from the end of the Civil War through the present day, through an assortment of very brief case histories as examples of attitudes, it will examine the roots of the persistent myth of a link between the two organizations. The roots of the persistent myth. There is no link. Boy, all the frothy zealots listening to this are going to be so grossly disappointed. Jeez. Sorry. There is no link. Jeez. Give your head a shake. So we'll begin. This paper began examining the role of the fraternity in the motives of implacable foes of the order, like Kansas Governor William B. Allen and J. Edgar Hoover. Not everybody was really on board. Hmm? It will then tackle the controversial and contested clan links of Masonic luminaries, Albert Pike, Warren G. Harding, and Harry S. Truman, and conclude with a look at the influence of fraternal beliefs in the policies and careers of clan leaders, like Nathan Bedford Forrest and William J. Simmons and Hiram Wesley Evans. Critical and objective. Is it any wonder we have to depend, that we need the academics to do what we would never touch? These are subjects that are so sensitive. It would be enormously difficult because I think it puts us on a path of ethical distress. For anybody to say that the answer is simple in any of this, what's the benefit if we're reacting to things that didn't happen, but somebody says they did? You know, speculation. Trying to convince with no foundation. And my Lord, brethren, this is not the first time, is it? How many times have we heard that if we've read our history about some force or people trying to gain advantage by saying things at us or about us that had absolutely no validity? None. And you know that. You know that for a fact. Anyway, it's self-serving of us to walk around saying it, isn't it? So, and the third paper on the same sensitive topic was Adam Kendall, an American. 34 years after the California Gold Rush and 18 years following the Civil War, the 22nd Triennial Conclave of Knights Templar was held in San Francisco. And this was the first ever west of the Rocky Mountains. In attendance were thousands of knights represented by two United States Grand Commanderies. In addition, state and city officials, newspaper publicity merchants, and the common. Citizens all took part in what was considered a modern demonstration of the might of the Masonic Knights Templar. Kendall explored a long-forgotten event as a view into the accomplishments and challenges within American society during the post-Civil War era. As the populace experienced the newfound mobility, they were able to see for the first time the expanse of their country and the promise of regenerated union. California's legendary status as a new Atlantis of rugged adventure, beauty, and wealth glittered as train travel made possible in a week what normally took months. He covered a short history of the Templar Triennials contextualized within Freemasonry and historical legend. And the presentation examined the American fascination with the West Coast and how the San Francisco Triennial was not just a parade 3,000 miles away. It was a true cultural exchange on a massive level, manifesting both fraternal and American mythologies long embedded via the newly completed transcontinental railway. Sources include the popular published recollection of the triennial by the Boston Commandery, which spared no expense as an escort for the most eminent Grand Commander, Benjamin Dean, as well as other primary documents held within the archive of the Grand Lodge of California in San Francisco. And Kendall finally included slides of relevant artifacts chronicling the triennial's activities, as well as other concurrent events that will help to illustrate the theme. Yes, it was sensitive. Jan Schnuck, who you've heard me speak about, Dr. Schnuck, professor, is absolutely one of the most interesting speakers I've ever had the pleasure to meet. And if you do have a chance to listen to this man's work, I would certainly encourage you. It is he is always has information that is defining, revealing, startling. He's so brilliant. And his work was on the rituals of the Union. And as we all know, in 2013, it's the bicentennial of the Union of the Grand Lodges of the Ancients and Moderns. Before the Union, which took place in December 1813, the Moderns had created the Lodge of Promulgation. It worked from April 1809 to March 1811, creating and promulgating new rituals for their lodges, which would be more acceptable to the ancients. Through the Articles of Union, the Lodge of Reconciliation was created to produce and promulgate rituals acceptable to all the lodges of the United Grand Lodge. Its work came to an end when its rituals were demonstrated before and accepted by the Grand Lodge in 1816. It is often assumed that these rituals were, in fact, largely those of the ancients. However, a group of former ancients lodges rejected the work of the Lodge of Reconciliation, which, in their view, quote, had altered all the ceremonies and language of Masonry and not left one sentence standing. Indeed, there can be no doubt that there are fundamental differences between the rituals of the Union and not only those of Pritchard's Masonry dissected in 1730, used by the moderns, but also those of three distinct Knox, which was printed in 1760, and Jakin and Boas, printed in 1762, which represent those of the ancients. Dr. Schnuck presented the innovations and analyzed their sources. And in fact, I was able to, sitting there, he had evidence that, in fact, the moderns had changed the wording, so much so that the ancients were quite correct, that they were quite correct in their claim that that there was that the moderns had changed the workings. So you can see the careful attention to not only the change, but if you're changing wording, you're changing meaning, aren't you? So apparently, well, we know today that the reconciliation of this in 1823 brought us, brought us into the form of a ritual that we have derived our own. Now, I want to move on with a paper by this is another one, Freemasonry in the Early 20th Century. This was offered by Pythagoras Petratos of Greece. And he talked about early Greek Freemasonry, the Philiki Eteria, or that's called the Friends Company. And he spoke about the establishment of the modern Greek state, and founded a few years before the start of the Greek Independence War. And it attracted a prominent membership from Greeks, mainly leaving or traveling abroad. And And the first of all, in not much research had been done on the topic, especially since this was there was a lack of historical resources about Freemasonry, if you can imagine. It is the purpose of his research to put more light onto the structure of Felice Italia and its similarities to Freemasonry. So he did that by looking at the examination, the membership, and secondly, the structure and ritual. Now, the fundamentals of Freemasonry have been used in different organizations, and I've heard comments from Knights of Columbus claiming that there is a strong parallels. Since I'm not a laic, I have to rely on their judgment, but it may be to say that Freemasonry is the sort of template for other organizations, or it's to perhaps say that the template used by Freemasonry has been in place for a great long time, and it can be put to other uses. Now, another paper on the Freemasonry in the early 20th century was offered by Yever Maver, and he's from Slovakia, and he did a paper on Freemasons and the modernization of society in the Kingdom of Hungary at the turn of the 19th and 20th century. And as he says, in connection with Freemasons in Hungary, the politics and public life got for the first time into the fore in the last decades of the 19th century by promoting the secularization laws that completed the equality of churches and transferred some operations like keeping the civil registers and marriage to the state authorities. Separation of church and state. The main points of Masonic modernization program of 1903 were the fullest application of the nationality law of 1868, correct and fair solution of the social and working class issues, reform of the jury courts, the reform of ecclesiastical policy, universal, equal, and secret suffrage, and the reform of agricultural ownership, public free public school system, and equal rights for women. In June of 1915, there were 82 lodges throughout the Hungarian kingdom with 7,370 members and with 477 members just in Slovakia. Discussions were held mainly on the need for the introduction of universal suffrage, the vote, to which several lectures in the Hungarian lodges took place. Of course, the rights, eh? Interestingly, the activation of the Hungarian Freemasonry in public life coincided with activation of the Slavic policies. The inclination of Freemasons in democratic reforms before the war was obvious. Interesting paper. Now we're rounding this off with getting into the final. These were the papers that started on Sunday, if you can imagine. If you weren't overwhelmed and had your appetite satiated by then, A Flood of Monks and Nuns, Freemasonry and French Exiles in Belgium between 1900 and 1914, outbreak of the First World War. In 1901, Loi de l'Association and the separation of church and state in 1905 were the most anti-clerical actions taken by the French government since the French Revolution. Non-authorized Catholic congregations and monastic orders were banned, and many of their members voluntarily chose to leave the country. In many respects, Belgium offered the best chance as their new homeland. There was a Catholic majority in Parliament, monastic life flourished, and the nation's constitution guaranteed freedom of religion and association. As a consequence, a vast network of Catholic associations and societies emerged. But in Freemasonry, the revival of 15,000 French monks and nuns as of 1901 posed no less than a threat to citizenship and a nationhood itself. The liberal and free-thinking Belgian Freemasonry always opposed the revival of monasticism. Religious orders were regarded as useless, anachronism and the embodiment of Catholic dogmatism. Especially toward the end of the century, many lodge meetings expressed anti-clerical and anti-Masonic, anti-monastic feelings. And not often were their members liberal politicians and opinion formers who battled the monasteries and other religious institutes in public. The arrival of the French confirmed and strengthened these opinions. The paper offered by Jimmy Cuppen of Belgium focused on the lodge's reactions concerning the so-called invasion of French exiles. It analyzed the Masonic discourse and the initiatives taken by some Freemasons to influence public opinion toward anti-clericalism. The arrival of the French also proved to revive Masonic interests in education. Many French nuns, for instance, now became a teacher in the Belgian Catholic schools and stimulated the myth of the convent as a hoard of greed, where monks and nuns illegally expanded its possessions. The fight against this so-called mortmain dominated both the blue lodges and the higher degrees of the years prior to the First World War. I use blue lodge because it's in front of me, not because, you know, its term is generally in Ontario is craft lodge. The last paper I asked, when I was speaking with Jan Schnuck, I was talking about, you know, what was happening with research into masonry. Because some programs had come to an end, and I needed to understand because, you know, we're quite keen on the development, and we see a great value, of course, in moving forward in the development of a research chair into masonry and things fraternal, and so it's wise to look at and listen to the experience of other people in other settings and see what can be gleaned from that. And he explained in no uncertain terms to go slowly, which I thought was very, very prudent. And he also explained that currently the best research in Freemasonry happening was coming out of France. And we didn't have a lot of time to get into the detail of that. But here's a paper offered by Cécile Revelgueux of France. And although several dictionaries on the history, rituals, and symbolism of Freemasonry or in short biographies of Masons were available, none really aimed at linking individual trajectories to the global picture. The purpose of her research was to provide scholars who specialize in masonry or in 18th century studies with an historical approach to over 1,000 Freemasons who lived in the age of the Enlightenment. Charles Poisset and Dr. Revelgueux set this purpose in mind and decided to try to find the best specialist for each name on the list. Remember, so they went through... Since Charles' death, he died, she continued on. What she created and completed on her own was a dictionary. 80% of the work was done by the time her colleague passed away. But she single-handedly went ahead and created a dictionary that listed the information about each Freemason and went back to the work from the 18th century. There were over 1,000. You can imagine how obscure that information would be. It was a massive undertaking, and the information is there. It's being translated into English, and it'll be there for all generations of researchers. So what she did was she began a study of the biography of each and put it into a context. So instead of just talking about describing somebody, they're wearing a white shirt. Describe the context. Where are they? What are they doing? And why is the mention of a white shirt important? Does it have any bearing on the audience? So that was how things wrapped up. Apart from that, and a general sense of, I think, the mood was self-congratulatory, and obviously so. There is no... This was a profoundly satisfying experience. Now, for those of you who have your pens and pencils handy or your crayon, go over to the wall and write down the name Susan Mitchell Sommers, S-O-M-M-E-R-S. She's just produced a book on Thomas Dunkerley, D-U-N-K-E-R-L-Y, sort of debunking the idea of the greatness of this fellow and his impact on Freemasonry. Historical records seem to be illustrating that this fellow was far less than what he claimed. And so it puts it into context. Another book reference that I want you to take a look at is something called The Uses and Abuses of Freemasonry, and that's by Smith. So take a look at that, and I think you'll find that would be kind of an eye-opener. I'm going to leave that. That's it. I will try not to mention in International Conference of History of Freemasonry, ICHF, until we get closing in on the event. We're going to be 2015, the spring of 2015. It's about a year and a half away. So bear with me. I want you to save up your, trade in your empties, trade in your pop bottles, and save up your pennies so that you can get, you can pay for the registration fee for the 2.5 days of pure, amazing academic research. It is not a Masonic event. It is about things Masonic. So the discussion has nothing to do with the discussion. It has everything to do with academics. That's the nature of it. And to our pleasure and acknowledgement, we are commitment to attend supports the work in part. It also, I think, defines the way that Freemasonry endorses education. We need to, and particularly about what we've been up to. We have no business pointing fingers at making claims when we can walk around with our head in the clouds about what's been going on with Freemasonry. To think that anything about Freemasonry is simple, maybe if you're very knowledgeable, everything becomes clear. But this is a great and growing order, and there are a lot of things that have happened. We have a very enriched history, and the history in different areas can tell us a great many things that would be that are helpful for today. It is what it is. We're so enormously fortunate to be part of this entire process. Now, when we finished off, you never finish with Masonic philosophy. We were talking, we were listening, reading on, and getting into an introduction of Wilmhurst's work, his pivotal work, and we were finding that he reflected thinking of the day. So many references to religious themes, so many, and it today I doubt that we would see these types of references being taken up in lodges. We are influenced by the secular environment that we live in. We are not. I don't think anybody's ever said there any. I've never seen a writing that suggests that Freemasonry should be a counterpoint for secularism. That would be, I think, impossible. Freemasonry is what it is. So is what it is. And so is society. Society takes on its own tasks and evolves in its own way. And so do we. So history, I think, the better the student of Freemasonry, the closer we are to our destiny. So, you heard it here. Judge for yourself, of course. Wilmhurst in this portion is talking to us about the import of teaching 3 degrees. And he claims that it's clear that from grade to grade, the candidate is being led from an old to an entirely new quality of life. He begins his Masonic career as the natural man. He ends it by becoming, through its discipline, a regenerated, perfect man. Look around. Look around. When you're in a lodge, how many and whom among you reflects an awareness of this type of thinking? That's not to put us on a scale of better to best. It's simply describing that not all the trees in the forest are the same. Some are smaller, some are larger, some are useful, some are not. But they're all trees in the forest. Some make a contribution and are shady and beautiful, and others are just, what, parasitic, if we look at what goes on in a woodlot. Living off of the energy of the organization. Freemasonry would be what? It never shakes us all down and says you can only walk through the door if you're able to make a contribution. It simply says, here, it's up to you to prove that our judgment wasn't wrong about you. And so to our brethren, I would say categorically, how do I say that to anybody? I would never, never, never. He begins, so we see the movement from natural to through some form of discipline to a regenerated perfect man. To attain this transmutation, this metamorphosis of himself, he is first taught to purify and subdue his sensual nature, then to purify and develop his mental nature. And finally, by utter surrender of his old life and losing his soul to save it, he rises from the dead as a master. A just man made perfect with larger consciousness and faculties, an efficient instrument for use by the great architect in his plan to rebuild the temple of fallen humanity, and capable of initiating and advancing other men to a participation in the same great work. Well, you're the temple. You are the expression of Freemasonry. You are Freemasonry. You're within an organization. You're within a great laboratory of ideas. You're within a fraternity. But you are Freemasonry. You are the molecules that are needed to hold things together in a very dynamic way. This, the evolution of man into Superman, was always the purpose of the ancient mysteries. And the real purpose of modern masonry is not the social and charitable purposes to which so much attention is paid, but the expediting of the spiritual evolution of those who aspire to perfect their own nature and transform it into a more godlike quality. And this is a definite science, a royal art, which it is impossible for each of us to put into practice. It's always possible, isn't it? Whilst to join the craft for any other purpose than to study and pursue it, this science is to misunderstand its meaning. Yep, we see misunderstanding. Hence it is that no one should apply to enter Masonry unless from the deepest promptings of his own heart, as it hungers for light upon the problem of its own nature. It's too bad, William Leslie, that the only way you would find that reference is by first becoming a Mason. This is sort of correcting after the fact. The horse is out of the barn, and we're saying, hey, it's run away. The answer is the true. We are all imperfect beings, he says, conscious of something lacking to us that would make us what, in our own best moments, we fain would be. What is that which is lacking to us? What is that which is lost? And the answer is the genuine secrets of a Master Mason. the true knowledge of ourselves, the conscious realization of our divine potentialities. What can you say? Yes, it's about self. You don't have to subscribe to Wilmshurst. I do. This is a book that I would think every Mason should read. But that said, do you understand everything that you read? What I think I'll do moving forward is speak to the master and the senior officers of my lodge about holding an educational workshop before every meeting. Not for everybody, but for the newer Masons. I have no desire or temperament to try and convince people who already have a mindset. It's more interesting to provide information for those who still have questions. But what do I know? Very little. Anyway, we have to wrap up this program, don't we? It always seems that the time goes so quickly. We're only a few weeks away from our annual communication in the middle of July at the Royal York in Toronto. I hope to see as many of you as possible. I hope to shake hands with you and to share anecdotes and ideas. You've heard me ask different questions throughout the show today, and yeah, I do need your advice. None of this is black and white and clear to me. Your opinions do matter, as earnest as they may be or as forthright as you can make them. It's the dialogue that goes on that I think is so important to our order. As a peace above all earthly dignities, a still and quiet conscience. There's nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. That comes from William Shakespeare. There's nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. God, he said, gives us our first face. You create the second. Live in thy shame, but die not shame with thee. Sometimes, you know, he makes you sit up. It makes you sit up, you know. As he said in Othello, reputation is an idle and most false imposition, oft got without merit and lost without deserving. I hope that you are looking for the Mason in your brethren. Look for the Mason. Don't look for that corporeal shell. Don't look for the shortcomings. This is a man just like you who is in a process of becoming. Look for his potential. He'll demonstrate by your leadership, your influence, by your own behavior. Not everybody gets that. It doesn't mean that they are incapable of it, but if you get it, then demonstrate that by looking for the Mason in the man. If you're true to your Masonic beliefs, you won't just contain Masonry within the walls of a lodge, but throughout your life. Look for the best in the people around you, and you will find it. If you choose not to, nobody's going to argue with you. That would be up to you. But you're making, you're trivializing a wonderful opportunity. And it's going to be abundantly hard, I think, harder for Masons than the average person, because we are taught so much about the altar that we are, that is in front of us. We have allegory poured over us, the pointing out that there is a connectiveness, that there is a philosophy and metaphysical communication throughout our degrees that helps us to become, go from being a natural man to a perfect man. So, do you give that willingly? Do you give that flexibility willingly? Commit as many acts of random kindness as you can over the next few days. I hope you are well. I truly do. I hope that you have a fabulous day. And that by the end of this day that you have felt completely satisfied that you have served some purpose and that that the world is in balance. In the meantime, see you soon. See you soon. Take care,
darling. Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing.
Always look on the bright side.
Pour arriver par ici, en paradis sans croix pour le son d'une voix. Autant de choses.